Chapter 10. What was the matter with me, Ravitch? Kate Hegstrom asked. She was lying in her bed, slightly raised, with two pillows under her head. The room had the odor of eau de santé and perfume. The window was slightly opened at the top. Clear, somewhat chilly air streamed in from the outside and mingled with the warmth of the room as if it were not January, but already April. You were feverish, Kate, for a few days. Then you slept. Almost 24 hours. Now the fever has gone and everything is fine. How are you feeling?
Tired. Still always tired. But different from before. Not so tense any more. I have hardly any pain.
You will have some later. Not very much, and we'll take care of it so you'll be able to stand it. But it won't stay the way it is now. You know that yourself.
She nodded. You have cut me up, Ravitch.
Yes, Kate.
Was it necessary?
Yes. He waited. It was better to let her ask.
How long will I have to be in bed?
A few weeks. She remained silent for a while.
I think it will be good for me. I need quiet. I'd had enough. I realize it now. I was tired. I did not want to admit it. Did this thing have something to do with it?
Certainly. Most certainly.
Also the fact that I had hemorrhages from time to time, between periods?
That too, Kate.
Then it's a good thing that I have time. Maybe it was necessary. To have to get up now and face all that again, I don't think I could do it.
You don't have to. Forget about it. Think only of the very next thing. For instance, of your breakfast.
All right.
She smiled faintly. Then pass me the mirror. He gave her the hand mirror from the night table. She studied herself attentively in it.
Are these flowers from you, Ravitch?
No, from the hospital. She put the mirror on the bed.
Hospitals don't send lilacs in January. Hospitals send asters or something like that. Neither do hospitals know that lilacs are my favorite flowers.
Here they do. Here you are a veteran, Kate. Ravitch got up. I have to go now. I'll come back about 6 o'clock to look after you.
Ravitch?
Yes? He turned around. Now it will come, he thought. Now she will ask. She extended her hand.
Thanks, she said. Thanks for the flowers. And thanks for looking out for me. I always feel safe with you.
All right, Kate. All right. There was nothing really to look out for. And now fall asleep again, if you can. In case you should have pains, call the nurse. I'll see that you get medicine. This afternoon I'll be back. Weber, where is the brandy? Was it as bad as that? Here's the bottle. Eugenie, get us a glass. Eugenie reluctantly went for a glass. That's a thimble, Weber protested. Get us a decent glass. Oh, wait, it might break your hand. I'll do it myself.
I don't know why it is, Dr. Weber, Eugenie declared bitingly. Whenever Mr. Ravitch comes, you...
All right, all right. Weber interrupted her. He poured a glass of cognac. Here, Ravitch, what does she believe?
She does not ask anything, Ravitch said. She trusts me without asking questions.
Weber glanced up. You see, he replied triumphantly, I told you so.
Ravitch emptied his glass.
Has a patient ever expressed his thanks to you when you couldn't do anything for him?
Often.
And believed everything?
Naturally.
And how did you feel about it?
Relieved, Weber said in astonishment. Very much relieved.
I feel like vomiting, like a fraud.
Weber laughed. He put the bottle aside again.
Like vomiting, Ravitch repeated.
That's the first human feeling I ever discovered in you, Eugenie said, except naturally for the way you express yourself.
You are not a discoverer, you are a nurse, Eugenie. You often forget that, Weber declared. The affair is settled, Ravitch, isn't it?
Yes, for the time being.
All right. She told the nurse this morning that she wants to go to Florence as soon as she leaves the hospital. Then we're in the clear.
Weber rubbed his hands.
The doctors over there can take care of it, then. I don't like it when someone dies here. It always hurts the reputation.
Ravitch rang the bell at the apartment door of the midwife who performed the abortion for Lucienne.
After some time, a sinister-looking man opened. He kept the latch in his hand when he saw Ravitch.
"What do you want?" he growled.
"I want to speak to Madame Boucher."
"She has no time."
"That doesn't matter. I'll wait a while." The man was about to close the door.
"If I can't wait, I'll be back in a quarter of an hour," Ravitch said, "but not alone. With someone who will certainly be able to see her."
The man stared at him.
"What does that mean? What do you want?"
"I told you. I want to speak to Madame Boucher." The man pondered.
"Wait," he said, and then closed the door.
Ravitch studied the peeling brown paint on the door, the tin letterbox, and the round enameled label with the name. A great deal of misery and fear had passed through this door. A few senseless laws which forced so many lives into the hands of quacks instead of doctors. No more children were born because of it. Whoever did not want a child found a way, law or no law. The only difference was that the lives of some thousands of mothers were ruined every year. The door was opened again.
"Are you from the police?"
the unshaven man asked.
"If I were from the police, I wouldn't be waiting here." "Come in."
The man showed Ravitch through a dark corridor into a room crowded with furniture. A plush sofa and a number of gilt chairs, an imitation Aubusson carpet, walnut verticos and pastoral prints on the walls. In front of the window stood a metal stand with a birdcage and a canary in it. Wherever there was any space, there were chinaware and plaster figurines. Madame Boucher came in. She was enormously fat and wore a kind of billowing kimono which was not quite clean. She was a monster, but her face was smooth and pretty, with the exception of her eyes, which darted restlessly.
"Monsieur?" she asked in a business-like tone and remained standing. Ravitch got up. "I come in behalf of Lucienne Martinet. You performed an abortion for her."
"Nonsense," the woman replied immediately with complete calm. "I don't know any Lucienne Martinet, and I don't perform abortions. You must be mistaken, or someone has told you a lie." She acted as if the affair was settled and was about to leave. But she didn't go. Ravitch waited. She turned around.
"Something else?"
"The abortion was a failure. The girl had serious hemorrhages and almost died. She had to have an operation. I operated on her."
"It's a lie," Madame Boucher suddenly hissed. "It's a lie. Those rats. They fool around trying to fix themselves up and then get other people into trouble. But I'll show her. Those rats. My lawyer will settle that. I am well known and a taxpayer, and I'll see whether such an impudent little slut that whores around—"
Ravitch studied her, fascinated. Her expression did not change during the outburst. It remained smooth and pretty. Her mouth only was drawn in and spat like a machine gun. "The girl wants very little," he interrupted the woman. "She only wants back the money she paid you."
Madame Boucher laughed. "Money? Pay back? When did I get any from her? Has she a receipt?"
"Naturally not. You wouldn't give any receipts."
"Because I've never seen her. And would anyone believe her?"
"Yes. She has witnesses. She was operated on in Dr. Weber's hospital. The diagnosis was clear. A report exists about it."
"You may have 1,000 reports. Where does it say that I touched her? Hospital, Dr. Weber, it's a scream. Such a rat goes to an elegant hospital. Haven't you got anything else to do?"
"I have. Listen, the girl paid you 300 francs. She can sue you for compensation." The door was opened. The sinister man entered.
"Something wrong, Adele?"
"No. Sue for compensation? If she goes to court, she herself will be sentenced. First of all, she, that's certain, because she admits that an abortion was done for her. That I did it still has to be proved. That she can't."
The sinister man bleated.
"Quiet, Roger," Madame Boucher said. "You may go."
"Brunier is outside."
"All right, tell him to wait. You know—"
The man nodded and left. With him went a strong smell of cognac. Ravitch sniffed.
"That's an old cognac," he said. "At least 30, 40 years old. Lucky man who drinks something like that early in the afternoon."
Madame Boucher stared at him for a moment, flabbergasted. Then she slowly drew in her lips.
"That's right. Do you want some?"
"Why not?"
In spite of her fat, she was at the door with surprising speed and silentness.
"Roger?"
the sinister man came in.
"You've been drinking the good cognac again. Don't lie, I smell it. Bring the bottle. Don't talk, bring the bottle."
Roger brought the bottle. "I gave Brunier some. He forced me to drink with him."
Madame Boucher did not answer. She closed the door and fetched a curved glass from the walnut vertigo.
Ravitch looked at it with disgust. The head of a woman was engraved on it. Madame Boucher poured and put the glass in front of him on the tablecloth, which was adorned with peacocks.
"You seem to be a sensible person, sir," she said.
Ravitch could not deny her a certain respect. She was not of iron, as Lucien had told him. She was worse, of rubber. You could break iron, not rubber. Her argument against collecting damages was sound. "Your operation was a failure," he said. "It had serious consequences. This should be reason enough for you to refund the money."
"Do you pay money back if a patient dies after an operation?"
"No, but sometimes we don't take any money for an operation. For instance, from Lucien."
Madame Boucher looked at him.
"You see? Then why is she making such a fuss? She should be glad."
Ravitch lifted his glass. "Madame," he said, "my respects. One can't get the better of you."
The woman slowly put the bottle on the table.
"Sir, many have already tried it, but you seem to be more sensible. Do you think this business is fun, or all the money mine? The police get almost 100 francs of those 300. Do you believe that I could work otherwise? One of them is sitting outside now to get money. I have to bribe them, always bribe them. There's no other way. I tell you that here, alone, between the two of us, and should you want to make use of it somehow, I'd deny it, and the police would pay no attention. You may believe that."
"I believe it." Madame Boucher cast a quick look at him. When she saw that he did not mean it ironically, she moved a chair closer to him and sat down. She moved the chair like a feather. Beneath her fat she seemed to have enormous strength. She refilled his glass with the cognac reserved for bribes.
300 francs looks like a good deal of money, but there are more expenses than just the police. The rent, naturally higher for me than for someone else. Laundry, instruments, for me twice as expensive as for physicians, commissions, bribes. I must be on good terms with everyone. Drinks, presents at New Year and on birthdays for the officials and their wives. That's something, sir. Sometimes hardly anything is left."
"I don't question that."
"Then what?"
"That the sort of thing can happen that happened to Lucien."
"Does it never happen with doctors?" Madame Boucher asked quickly.
"Not so often, by far."
"Sir," she straightened up, "I'm honest. I tell every one of the girls who come here that something might happen, and none of them leaves. They beg me to do it. They cry and are desperate. They would commit suicide if I didn't help them. What scenes have been staged here? They roll on the rug and entreat me. Do you see the corner of that vertigo there where the veneer is chipped off? A well-to-do lady did that in her desperation. I took care of her. Do you want to see something? 10 pounds of plum jam she sent yesterday are in the kitchen, out of pure gratitude, although she had paid. I'll tell you something, sir."
Madame Boucher's voice rose and became fuller. "You may call me an abortionist. Others call me their benefactress and angel." She had got up. The kimono billowed around her majestically. The canary began to sing in his cage as if by command. Ravitch got up. He had a feeling for melodrama, but he knew too that Madame Boucher did not exaggerate. "All right," he said. "I'll go now." "For Lucien, you weren't exactly a benefactress."
"You should have seen her before. What more does she want? She's healthy, the child is done with, that was all she wanted. And she doesn't have to pay for the hospital."
"She'll never be able to have a child again." Madame Boucher hesitated a second only.
"All the better," she declared unmoved. "Then she will be overjoyed, that little whore."
Ravitch realized that there was nothing to be done. "Au revoir, madame," he said. "It has been interesting here with you."
She came close to him. Ravitch would have liked to avoid shaking hands with her, but that was not her intention. She lowered her voice in a confidential manner.
"You are sensible, sir, more sensible than most doctors. It's a pity that you—"
She hesitated and looked at him encouragingly.
"Sometimes one needs, for certain cases, an understanding physician could then be of great help."
Ravitch did not object. He wanted to hear more.
"It would not harm you,
Madame Boucher added, just in special cases. She studied him like a cat that pretends to love birds. There are well-to-do clients among them sometimes, naturally always payment in advance, and we are safe, completely safe from the police. I assume you could very well use a few hundred francs on the side. She tapped him on his shoulder. A good-looking man like you. She seized the bottle with a broad smile. Well, what do you think?
Thanks, Ravitch said, and kept her from pouring. No more. I can't stand much.
He refused with great reluctance, for the cognac was excellent. The bottle had no label and certainly came from a first-class private cellar.
I'll think the other matter over. I'll come again sometime. I'd like to see your instruments. Maybe I can give you some advice as far as they are concerned.
I'll show you my instruments when you come again. Then you'll show me your papers. Confidence for confidence.
You've already shown me some confidence.
Not the least. Madame Boucher smiled. I only made you a proposition which I can deny at any time. You're not a Frenchman, one can hear that, although you speak well. Nor do you look it. You're probably a refugee.
She smiled more broadly and looked at him with cool eyes.
One wouldn't believe you, and would be at best interested in the French diploma, which you haven't got. Outside in the hall sits a police official. If you want to, you can denounce me right away. You won't do it, but you can think over my proposition. You wouldn't give me your name and address, would you?
No, Ravitch said, feeling beaten.
I thought not.
Madame Boucher really looked like a huge, well-fed cat now.
Au revoir, monsieur. Consider my offer. I've often before thought of working with the assistance of a refugee doctor.
Ravitch smiled. He knew why. A refugee doctor would be completely at her mercy. If anything happened, he would be guilty. I'll think it over, he said. Au revoir, madame.
He walked along the dark corridor. Behind one of the doors he heard someone moaning. He assumed that the rooms were arranged like small cabins with beds. The women would stay there before they tottered home. A slim man with a trimmed moustache and an olive-coloured skin sat in the hall. He studied Ravitch attentively. Roger sat at his side. He had another bottle of the old cognac on the table. He tried to hide it instinctively when he saw Ravitch. Then he grinned and dropped his hand.
Bonsoir, doctor, he said, and showed his stained teeth. It seemed he had been eavesdropping at the door.
Bonsoir, Roger.
It seemed to Ravitch appropriate to be intimate. This indestructible woman had almost changed him from an outspoken enemy into an accomplice within half an hour in there, and so it was actually a relief to be not too formal with Roger, who, after all that, had something astonishingly human about him. Downstairs he met two girls. They were looking from door to door.
"Sir,"
one of them asked with determination, "does Madame Boucher live here in this house?"
Ravitch hesitated. But what point was there in saying anything? It would not help at all. They would go. Then, too, he could not give them any other directions. On the third floor, there is a nameplate on the door.
The luminous dial of his watch shone in the dark like a tiny imitation sun. It was 5 o'clock in the morning. Joan should have come at 3. It was still possible that she would come. Also possible that she was too tired and had gone straight to her hotel. Ravitch stretched out to go back to sleep. But he could not fall asleep. He lay awake for a long time and looked at the ceiling where the red band from the electric signs on the roof opposite ran at regular intervals. He felt empty and did not know why. It was as if the warmth of his body were slowly seeping through his skin, and as if his blood wanted to lean against something that was not there, and that it fell and fell into a soft nothingness. He crossed his hands behind his head and lay quiet. Now he knew he was waiting. And he knew it was not only his consciousness that waited for Joan Madou. His hands waited, and his veins, and a strangely alien tenderness within him. He got up, put on his dressing gown, and sat down by the window. He felt the warmth of the soft wool on his skin. The robe was old. He had had it with him for many years. He had slept in it on his flights. He had warmed himself in it during the cold nights in Spain when, dead tired, he had come back from the field hospital to his barracks. Juana, 12 years old, with eyes 80 years old, had died under it in a wrecked hotel in Madrid. with the single wish sometime to own a dress of the same soft wool, and to forget how her mother had been ravished and her father trampled to death. He looked around. The room, a few suitcases, some belongings, a handful of well-read books. A man needed few things to live. And it was good not to get used to too many things when life was unsettled. Again and again one had to abandon them, or they were taken away. One should be ready to leave every day. That was the reason he had lived alone. When one was on the move, one should not have anything that could bind one, nothing that could stir the heart, the adventure, but nothing more. He looked at the bed, the crumpled, colourless linen. It did not matter that he waited. He had often waited for women. But he felt that he had waited differently, simply, clearly, and brutally. Also, sometimes with the anonymous tenderness that enchases desire with silver, but for a long time not as he waited today. Something had crept into him to which he had not paid any attention. Did it stir again? Did it move? How long ago was it? Did something call again out of oblivion, out of the blue depths? Did it again blow across him like the breath of meadows full of peppermint, with a row of poplars against the horizon and the smell of woods in April? He did not want to possess anything. He did not want to be possessed. He was on the move. He got up and began to dress. One must remain independent. Everything began with small dependencies. One did not notice them much, and suddenly one was entangled in the net of habit. Habit for which many names existed. Love was one of them. One should not grow accustomed to anything, not even to a body. He did not lock the door. If Joan came, she would not find him. She could stay if she wanted to. He deliberated for a second whether to leave a note, but he did not want to lie, nor did he want to tell her where he had gone. He returned about 8 o'clock in the morning. He had walked in the cold under the street lights of early dawn, and had felt clear and relaxed. But as he stood in front of the hotel, he felt again the tenseness. Joan was not there. Ravitch assured himself that he had not expected anything else. But his room seemed to him emptier than usual. He looked around and searched for a sign of her having been there. He found nothing. He rang for the maid. She came after a while. "I'd like some breakfast," he said. She looked at him. She said nothing. He didn't want to ask her any questions. "Coffee and croissant, Eve."
"Very well, Mr. Ravitch."
He looked at the bed. If Joan had come, one could not very well have expected her to lie down in a crumpled, empty bed. Odd how dead everything became that had to do with the body when there was no longer any warmth. A bed, underwear, even a bath. It was repulsive when it had lost its warmth. He lighted a cigarette. She might have assumed that he had been called to see a patient, but then he could have left a note. Suddenly he thought himself a good deal of an idiot. He wanted to be independent, and succeeded only in being inconsiderate. Inconsiderate and foolish, like an 18-year-old who wants to prove something to himself. There was more dependency in this than if he had waited. The girl brought his breakfast.
"Shall I do the bed now?" she asked.
"Why now?"
"In case you still want to go to sleep. One sleeps better in a freshly made bed."
She looked at him without expression. "Was someone here?" he asked.
"I don't know. I only came at 7.
"Eve," he said, "how does it feel to have to make a dozen strangers' beds every morning?"
"It's all right, Mr. Ravitch, as long as the people don't want anything else. But there are always a few who want more, though the brothels are so cheap in Paris.
In the morning one can't go into a brothel, Eve, and some guests feel particularly strong in the morning."
"Yes, especially the old ones." She shrugged her shoulders.
"You lose the tip if you don't do it, that's all. Then, too, some make complaints every minute afterwards, that the room is not clean or that you are fresh, naturally out of anger. You can't do anything about it. That's how life is." Ravitch pulled a bill out of his pocket. "Let's make life somewhat easier today, Eve. Buy yourself a hat with that, or a woolen jacket." Eve's eyes lost their dull expression.
"Thank you, Mr. Ravitch. Today is starting well. Then should I make your bed later?"
"Yes." She looked at him.
"The lady is a very interesting lady," she said. "The lady who keeps coming here now."
One more word and I'll take the money away from you. Ravitch pushed Eve out of the door. The old lechers are waiting for you. Don't disappoint them. He sat down at the table and ate. The breakfast did not taste particularly good. He got up and continued to eat standing. It tasted better. The sun hung red above the roofs. The hotel was waking up. Old man Goldberg on the floor below began his morning concert. He coughed and groaned as if he had six lungs. The refugee Wiesenhoff opened his window and whistled a parade march. On the upper floor, water gushed. Doors were slammed. Ravitch stretched himself. The night had gone. The corruption of the dark was done with. He decided to remain alone for a few days. Outside, the newspaper boys were calling out the morning news. Incidents at the Czechoslovakian frontier, German troops at the Sudeten line, the Munich Pact jeopardized.